Comic Book Time Machine, episode 21, giant size, Marvel licensed sci-fi super special, John Carter, Warlord of Mars, annual number one, featuring the Marv Wolfman interview. It's true. Marv Wolfman is a special guest, time traveler, in this episode. Welcome, time travelers, to a super special episode of the Comic Book Time Machine. If you are a new listener tuning in, like it's a radio, it's not. If you're a new listener downloading and plugging in to this because of the main event, the Marv Wolfman interview, I'm just going to give you a brief introduction to this podcast. Comic Book Time Machine is a podcast where we go back in time and just look at comic books, whether a week old or seven decades old. It doesn't really matter. It's just we're looking for things and reading things that we enjoy, and then we talk about. And so for one of the things that I'm doing, we have group episodes where we talk about group topics, me, Matt Anderson, Daniel Butcher, my two co-hosts. But then we also have solo episodes where we talk about things that are in our wheelhouse, things that we just really enjoy and want to read and talk about. For me, that means going back and looking at Marvel's Star Wars. And I'm using Marvel's Star Wars as kind of a launching point to talk about other Marvel-licensed sci-fi books. So, for example, in the last episode, I talked about Marvel's Star Wars number 4, which is the fourth chapter in their adaptation of the first movie. I read Human Fly number 2, which is licensed from a real-life stuntman, although boy, oh boy, I might have gotten myself into something bad there by reading that series. We'll find out when I start number 3 next time. I read the Island of Dr. Moreau adaptation that they did, which is a special, a Marvel super movie special kind of thing. And I also read the third issue of Godzilla, where he meets the champions and fights Hercules. It's not as awesome as it sounds, but it's still got some awesome moments to it. And then finally, I read John Carter of Mars number 5, which has just been consistently month to month to month so far awesome. I wish I would have discovered this book earlier, but I didn't. I'm still enjoying myself reading the series. One of the things that came up, though, in that month, and this is October 1977 is the cover date, but the month that they were released in was July 1977, and one of the things that was also released in that month was John Carter, Warlord of Mars, Annual Number 1. Now, I heard talking about a number of different books, and so I thought maybe it'd be cool if I would break out the annuals and actually spend a little more time with them and do something special. The question was, what? What do I do? So my first thought, invite a guest. And my first impulse was to find someone who liked what I'm reading and invite them. And this wouldn't be hard. Just off the top of my head, I can think Steve McDonald, Daniel Butcher. Those are both guys that I podcast with. We have a rapport already, and they both really like John Carter, Warlord of Mars. Right there, there's two guys, two awesome guys that I could pull in. But I went to Wizard World Chicago a couple weeks back, and it was a great convention for me. I met a lot of awesome people. I reconnected with some artist friends of mine that I haven't seen in years. The artist for the Hedge Knight, Mike Miller, he was there, and so we were able to reconnect and have, you know, go out to eat in the evenings together, and I met some of his friends and made some new relationships. That was great. It was a lot of fun. Also, I did something that I've never done at a convention in over 10 years of going to comic book conventions. I brought something from home to have someone sign because I saw that Marv Wolfman was going to be there. Now, Michael Golden was also going to be there. He's an artist from Micronauts and some other things, but I didn't bring anything for him to sign. I wish I had, but then again, I'm actually kind of glad I didn't because I bought one of his prints. Actually, two, a Micronauts print and a Star Wars print that'll go up on the wall in my office when I finally do our basement and renovate our basement so I can have my office downstairs. That's another story. Marv Wolfman was there, and I actually, you know, took my John Carter Warlord of Mars omnibus, the very book that I'm using for this podcast as I'm reading through the John Carter books to go along with the Star Wars books, and I took it. I had him sign it. I made a fool out of myself talking to him. I bumbled my words, and I just really made a complete and utter fool out of myself. Or at least I felt really foolish after I spoke to him. It wasn't that I felt foolish because of anything that he had done. I just felt foolish because of the way I had talked to him. With that fresh in my mind, though, I thought, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to try and contact him and see if he'd be willing to talk about John Carter and talk about his career. And I sent him an email with that foolish conversation that we had fresh in my mind, hoping he would get the email and he would not remember the foolish conversation. Wouldn't be as fresh in his mind. Fortunately, I don't think he did. At least he never said anything about it. And I don't know. I mean, obviously on email, he wouldn't see my face anyway. So I was able to sneak in. But anyway, he was very willing to do the interview, and I was very, very excited, very honored, and very touched, actually, that he was willing to do that. So briefly, before we get into the interview, I do want to give some background to both John Carter and to Marv Wolfman here. Over 100 years ago, John Carter made his first trip to Mars in a pulp magazine serial called Under the Moons of Mars. Now, we know that book today as A Princess of Mars, and it became the inspiration for many different high adventure, sci-fi, pulp, superhero things to follow, to come after that. And John Carter matters to me, and should, if you're listening to this podcast, he matters to you. You may not like him. As a character, you may not like the books or the stories, but he matters to you as well. And the reason he matters to us is because so much of our pop culture lineage can be traced back to that superhero of Mars. Superman himself, considered rightly so, to be the most influential, if not the first, of superheroes. He was influenced by John Carter. And Siegel himself actually said in an interview, he said, Carter was able to leap great distances because the planet of Mars was smaller than the planet Earth. And he had great strength. And I visualized the planet Krypton as a huge planet, much bigger than Earth. Now, this was a 1983 interview that it's been cited in many, many places online. But honestly, I can't find the actual original source, and at least online I can't. And so I'm not sure where, you know, I'm not sure about the legitimacy of the quote, but legitimate or not, it's how I see it. It's hard not to see that original Superman, who could only leap great distances in a single bound, not being influenced by John Carter, who could do what? Leap great distances in a single bound. And okay, so if he influences Superman, then Superman influences everything past him, you know, as far as superheroes and that kind of thing. But then don't even get me started then about Star Wars and all of the different things that Star Wars pulled from John Carter. And honestly, some of these sci-fi ideas that Star Wars would have gotten from John Carter actually might have come from things that got them from John Carter. I mean, John Carter was one of the first times that we saw a pulp hero in these settings. And if it wasn't the first, and I can't tell you, I don't know, I'm not a historian, a John Carter historian. However, if not the first, it was the greatest of the influences. And it did well enough to have these influences. Now, here's just a small list, though, from Star Wars. You have the Banths from John Carter and Banthas from Star Wars. Sith are in John Carter. There are some sort of evil insect. Sith are in Star Wars. There's some sort of evil Jedi. Jedd and other variations on that word are kings and queens in John Carter, and Jedi warriors are in Star Wars. Padawars are officers in John Carter. Padawans in Star Wars are Jedi in training. Those are just words that have, you know, similar sounding. And if there's just one or two, you could maybe take it as a coincidence. But the fact that there's so many of them, that's not coincidence. It just, you know, I hate coincidence. And we're going to talk about coincidence later. This can't be coincidence, not the way it's happening here. Now, there's also concepts and stuff. You know, the flying ships soaring over, and when I say ship, I mean like ocean liner type ships flying over desert landscapes. And you know, even Princess Leia's bikini in Return of the Jedi. Now, are these things ripoffs? Maybe it's more homage, and maybe it's just influence, like I said before. But it's definitely influence. I mean, you can take it past influence into ripoff territory if you want. I'm not going there. I'm just saying this was a big influence on what came behind. And so I won't say that John Carter was the best even of these things that were doing that, those kind of stories, but it definitely was one of the first, and one of, if not the first to actually happen, it was one of the first to really capture imaginations of future creators who would do the same, and so on and so on. So Superman's creators were influenced and inspired. Superman then became an influence and an inspiration of all these other characters, and so on and so on and so on. And the lineage can be traced, a lot of it can be traced back to John Carter. Now, one of those creators who got caught under Edgar Rice Burroughs' Barsoomian spell was Marv Wolfman. And what's cool about Marv Wolfman is that he wasn't just caught in the spell. He was actually one of the lucky people who got to become a part of the legacy that inspired him by working on these original stories that were, you know, wrapped into, if not official canon, it became a part of the legacy and the history of the character as far as outside canon. I mean, as far as it happened, it's literal. It was in history that Marv Wolfman got to do this. Now, so far, the material that we've covered by Marv Wolfman have been original stories. The Air Pirates of Mars so far has just been something that he created by himself. But the reason for this special episode is Annual Number 1, and it is not a part of that series of stories. Instead, it's Marv Wolfman's adaptation of one of Edgar Rice Burroughs' later works, the novella The Ancient Dead, from a book called Lana of Gathol. I'm not going to get these names right, but Lana of Gathol is the 10th book in the John Carter series and the second to last book in Edgar Rice Burroughs' series of books. It has four novellas that are connected. So even though they're four different stories and four complete stories with the beginning, middle, and end, they also go together as a united whole. I read the book first before reading the comic, and that novella was a breezy read with an awesome concept, maybe even a couple awesome concepts in there. But there were two bits in it that turned me against the story. I mean, these things caused me to just turn my head, cross my arms, you know, scowl. Basically stupid coincidences that should have never been written into the story. And I'm sorry, Mr. Edgar Rice Burroughs, I respect you and enjoy your writing, but this one just kind of, it fell at my feet like a brick. So as I was reading, the only thing I could think was, I hope that Marv Wolfman fixed this stupid story beats in his adaptation. And he does make changes in his adaptation. So there's that. Did he fix it? Does his adaptation fix the story, or does it break it? Well, we'll get to that later. For right now, it's time to go ahead and actually begin with the main event. Marv Wolfman is known, of course, for much more than the John Carter Warlord of Mars books. He's actually perhaps best known for Crisis on Infinite Earths, and he's also known for his run on Teen Titans, making that just a powerhouse title. He's also well known for Tomb of Dracula, one of my favorite comic books ever, of all time. And that's also the title where he created Blade. Now, that's the comic character that is responsible for comic book movies' rise in popularity over the last, you know, 15 or so years. Without Blade, we wouldn't have had X-Men or Spider-Man and the MCU, which Daniel Butcher and I owe a great deal of gratitude to Marv Wolfman for creating Blade to connect the dots to Welcome to Level7.com. But anyway, to say he left a mark on the comic book industry is a huge, huge understatement. So I'm going to run the interview now, and then afterward I'm going to explore his adaptation of John Carter in The Ancient Dead. Mr. Wolfman, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to out of your hectic and busy schedule, especially with some of the things you're telling me about off microphone. But thank you so much for joining me on the Comic Book Time Machine.
No problem. It should be fun.
Yeah. So John Carter is the main reason why I contacted you. So I'd like to start with John Carter with our conversation. And honestly, I'd like to start at the beginning. What attracted you in the first place to John Carter?
I think that I don't remember why I read the first John Carter, but it was certainly as a young teenager. And I felt that as I'm reading it, I was reading the kind of stuff that I really enjoyed, really loved, but had not seen much of before. Comics were certainly adventuresome. There were science fiction elements to comics, but not a lot. Occasionally, Superman would fly to another planet, but not as often as one would think. John Carter was a pure romantic tale of a person coming from Earth, going from Earth to Mars, meeting the aliens, meeting really interesting type of characters, a very different feeling that I had ever seen before, but exactly the type of stuff that I loved. And it drew me in.
So you had read these long before you had done any writing for the comics then?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
So what got you involved in doing John Carter at DC to start with?
I was Joe Kubert's assistant editor, working for him on the Tarzan and all the Edgar S. Burroughs material, and also the war books that Joe was doing. Joe had to hire an assistant to work in the office because he was busy drawing, so he could only come in maybe once or twice a week, and I'd handle the day-to-day type of functions within the office. When we got Tarzan, he decided that he would put John Carter as the backup feature to Tarzan, a short story, and I lobbied hard to get it. Joe was going to write it, but he really didn't have any feeling for John Carter and said so. He was just going to do it because he was going to do it. So he was – the fact that I really loved the character and really was pushing to write it, he let me handle it.
So – but then you have this really – I think it's an unusual situation where – the character changes publishers, and you change publishers with the character. And when Marvel got the license, suddenly there's Marv Wolfman on the license there too. So how did that work out?
That was a coincidence. When John Carter went from the back of Tarzan to half of a magazine called Weird Worlds, another comic that also featured Carson of Venus as one of the features, and John Carter and Carson of Venus would split the book. When the book was finally canceled, I was already at Marvel. In fact, Roy Thomas let me finish off the last few issues of the John Carter stories while I was at Marvel, which was very unusual at the time, but he knew I loved the character. In between DC and Marvel getting the license, Edgar Rice Burroughs was going to publish the books themselves. And I was hired to work on the John Carter material and wrote one story that was going to be drawn by Rudy Nebry. I'm sorry, not Rudy Nebry, Alex Nino. And Alex drew the story that I wrote. But by that point, by the time he finished, Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated decided not to publish themselves but to license it to Marvel. Now, I was already working at Marvel, as I say, and Roy knew how much I love the character since I begged to be allowed to finish my DC run while I was there. So even though Roy wanted to write John Carter tremendously, he also wanted to write Tarzan. So he let me do the John Carter material.
Okay. So it was a very happy coincidence then.
Very happy coincidence. Yeah.
So looking back then at your DC Marvel, because I'm mostly familiar with your Marvel, I only have one issue that I found in a back issue bin of the Weird Worlds.
Dark Horse, strangely enough, reprinted them.
Yeah, you mentioned that in actually you mentioned that when I met you at Wizard World, and I went to Amazon to see if I could get a copy of that because I only had the one issue of Weird Worlds, and I can't really compare the two, the DC and the Marvel, really well. It's the Marvel stuff that I'm reading through right now, and just really it excites me every issue.
Thank you. There's a big difference. There's a big problem with the DC material, certainly when it went into Weird Worlds. And the problem was the books were not doing very well, and the license time for John Carter, for all the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff, was slowly coming to an end. And every month we were told this would be the last issue. And then it was continued. So what happened was we never really got to tell a story in Weird Worlds that we had wanted to tell. I wanted to do an adaptation, actually, of Princess of Mars. And what happened was every issue, it felt like we were ending it, then starting it again, the next issue. So the last few issues are not very good because it didn't have a direction. When we were doing it at Marvel, obviously I knew this was the beginning of the run, no matter how long it lasted, so I was able to do what I think is a much better job.
So at Marvel, you did original stories to start with. I mean, that first arc, the Air Pirates or Sky Pirates arc, that's all original. That's all you filling in the gap between basically two paragraphs of Princess of Mars. So what kind of freedoms did it give you? But what kind of also challenges did that cause for you?
my view is if you can do original material set in the universe, it could be more interesting. The people who love John Carter had already read the novels. And just to illustrate them, that's fun, but it may be more fun to try something new. And what I wanted to do was really immerse myself in the style of Edgar Rice Burroughs and to write the stories the way I thought he would have done them today. Or back in 1970, yeah. Whatever, yeah. So what I wanted to do was try to do an Edgar Rice Burroughs-like John Carter story, not a Marv Wolfman one. It had a very different sensibility from my other writing. And since I was pretty knowledgeable at that point with all the John Carter material, I didn't think that would be a major problem. Plus, it got to be exciting. So even the Edgar Rice Burroughs fans would not have an idea of what we were going to do next.
Yeah,
that everything was going to be an original story rather than, oh, we know exactly where this is going.
Well, and that's one thing, I think probably my greatest compliment to that material is that even though I know John Carter can't die, and I know Tars Tarkin's not going to die, Deja Thoris, she's not going anywhere, because this is in the first book still, it's not about what's going to happen, but it's how are we going to get there? Right. How are they going to get to the end there? And you managed to find things that are surprising me. Of course, I'm reading it now new, and I have no idea what to expect as I'm going step by step through the issues. Right. And they're surprising me, and that's what's a prequel of any sort. Darth Vader's going to end up being Darth Vader, or Anakin's going to, because you've already seen the end of the story. It's just how you get there, and that's really what I enjoyed about reading it right now, is just that level of surprise.
Thank you. It's always interesting when you look at a book written 50 years ago, almost, because it was written in the 70s, so it's 45 years old or something like that. Styles change. I was a beginning writer when I was doing that. I was still only in the business a couple of years, desperately still learning my trade. I have not reread the material because I think of it, all of the material I wrote back then, as probably very dated and very crude compared to where I am today. But I worked the hardest I was able to make sure that John Carter got good stories, and I just hope that it did. But I know that it's got to be dated in the type of writing. But then again, so is Edgar Rice Burroughs' books.
That's true.
And I read them. They were very 1910. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you as someone who, I'm 40 now, and so the book is almost as old as I am, but I'm not feeling that it's dated. I am feeling definitely it has that 70s style. It does have that kind of vibe to the captioning, although the first person captions that you were using, which goes along with the books, but that feels fresh. And again, once you put a first person caption on something, the guy's not going to die.
Unless he's already dead when he's telling the story.
Right, unless he's...
I was never trying to convince anyone John Carter could die, because there were 10 novels out there.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to surprise you within the context of the stories.
Yeah, well, and you've succeeded.
Thank you.
You did succeed, I should say. But, let's move back onto your career then. As far as like the beginning of your career, what brought you into comics in general as a reader or as a fan of comics? What brought you into that?
I was very young, obviously, when I saw Superman on television, the George Reeves shows, the first time they were aired, and I had never seen anything like it before. It was the very concept of a superhero was brand new to me. I never saw comic books, but I was only, 6 or 7 or 8. When I was watching that stuff, and at the end of it, it says that Superman's based on the copyrighted characters appearing in Superman and Action Comics. And I went out with my friend that day, that evening after the Superman show, and we bought our very first comics. It's not as ridiculous as it sounds, because we didn't have, even at 7 or 8, we couldn't cross the street, but we had 2 candy stores on our block that sold comics.
Okay.
And I didn't have to walk more than a couple hundred yards to a store to buy it. Never had to cross the street. I had a dime, and my friend had a dime, and we bought 2 comic books that day. And if you've never seen adventure material done in that format, if you've never seen a superhero, if they did not ever exist in your life, which is impossible today,
right?
And this is the first time you're being exposed to anything that had that sort of a thought process behind it, and you were inclined towards that just because of the way you were, you're drawn in immediately.
So you were already then, what were you reading other than, before you started reading the comics, before you bought, what kind of things were you into? Like Treasure Island or like the adventure novels or just?
Novels were still probably a year or two away.
Okay.
As I said, 7 or 8 at most. So I wasn't reading books then, and they didn't have books for my age.
Oh, okay.
They would have had children's books. If you base everything on today, nobody understands what the world was like then. But they didn't have books for 7, 8-year-olds. They had books for little kids. The best I was reading, but this came a couple years later, was the Tom Swifts and the Hardy Boys and all of that. But again, I had already been reading comics when I discovered those.
So those you discover those comics at right that sweet point, that just perfect moment in your life.
Yeah, I knew how to read because I was reading stuff for school, but I hadn't found anything yet that I wanted to read on my own.
So what were some of your favorites back then?
Comic books?
Yeah, yeah.
There weren't many being published. Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman were the only superheroes being published anywhere. I liked Strange Adventures and Mystery in Space, but I also read the Archies, and I also read Casper the Friendly Ghost and all of those. I don't think I was ever a big fan of the Casper stuff, but I read it because I was reading comics, and there were so few comics being published.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, it was any kind of comic that came my way. It didn't matter. just because it was.
Same here.
So then, lifelong fan, I guess, then you move into it as your career. How does that happen? What brought you in as a professional then?
I studied to be an artist. I wanted to draw comics, and I always wrote stories for myself to draw, and I published fan magazines and called fanzines.
Mm-hmm.
And first I contributed to others, and then I wrote and drew my own, and everybody said that my writing was a lot better than my art, and that was true. And so I'd continue to write stories, but back then, again, there was only DC and Marvel doing this type of material. And it was the very beginning of Marvel. So I would send copies of the fanzines to a couple of the editors. And one of them, or two of them actually, got back to me saying, if you ever want to try writing a story for House of Mystery or House of Secrets, please do. Because I was publishing a horror fanzine filled with horror stories, as well as a superhero fanzine, and as well as a comedy fanzine.
So you covered everything then, except for romance.
I didn't care about that. What 12-year-old boy does,
right.
At least back then. Still a few more years to go. But if I enjoyed it, I published a fanzine of that type of material.
Nice. And so that led to your work with DC on the anthology books there? And then that led to Tarzan. The John Carter and...
Tarzan book.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
The John Carter backup, yes.
So, all right. Well, would you, when you think then back, especially as an early writer, not necessarily back to when you were a child, but as an early writer, and you're getting into the comic scene and that kind of thing, what comic creators would you look back on and look at them as maybe inspirations, or maybe even as like mentors helping you with your craft? Who would you look to back then as that inspiration?
We have to understand they didn't put credits on comics for most years, for many, many years, so you never knew who did what. Later on, they started to add the credits. And I would find pretty much anything Stan Lee did, I loved. At DC, it would be John Broome and some of the Gardner Fox stuff. Some of the Bob Kaniger stuff, and a few of the other writers here and there. But we didn't always know who did what because of the lack of credits. None of them were my mentor, but of the two that influenced me most at DC, it would have been John Broome, and at Marvel, it would have been Stan.
Okay. Now, you've worked on... Okay, so you started out on House of Secrets, House of Mystery, and these little anthologies, but then, you know, your career goes everywhere, and you worked on some of the... some touchstones in both DC history, but also in comic history in general. So you have these big things, you know, you run on Teen Titans and, you know, Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is obviously...
But that's later.
Yeah, but what things do you look at now that maybe didn't get the limelight that those other books got, but that you feel proud about, or you think, oh, you know, this is something I wish more people would read?
That's always hard to say, because so many of the books did well, and I'm not phrasing myself there, but I think most of them, you know, I could say A Man Called Nova at Marvel didn't get the attention back then that it actually gets now. I find so many people who are fans of that book now, but it wasn't the big book at Marvel at the time, but I really loved doing it. At DC, it would have been a book like Night Force, which I really loved writing. Those are the only two books that didn't have the sales that I wish they had, but turns out that Nova probably sold a lot better than we thought, because I can't believe how many people today are major Nova fans. The fact that the Nova Corps was a major player in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie shows that if you're a certain age, you probably read the Nova comic and brought that stuff into it, because there was no connection between Nova and the Guardians prior to the movie, as far as I know.
How does that feel to see some of those things showing up on the screen that you either created or had a hand in developing anyway, or giving voice to?
Oh, it's wonderful. It essentially says that the stuff that you did for fun, because we did this type of material we wanted to do and have fun with it, and just this, certainly those days at Marvel, we were in charge of our own books, so we did what we wanted. And it says pretty much that the things that we wanted to do resonate even today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great feeling. And then, of course, with conventions, you have people coming up to you telling you how important a book was to them at a certain point in their life, and you never heard those stories before. People didn't write to you telling you that. But now those people are in their 40s and above, and they're coming up to me at a convention, and it's just an incredible feeling.
And I have to ask, again, going back to John Carter then, what'd you think of the movie? I mean, you didn't create John Carter, but you are a part of John Carter history.
I liked it. I thought that it truly represented the type of material that was in the Burroughs material. I did not have the problems that a lot of people have with it. I think the biggest problem with it is, good as the actors are, I didn't sense any chemistry between the actor who played John Carter and the actress who played Deja Thoris.
Mm-hmm.
Both fine actors. I'm not talking about their quality, but I didn't sense chemistry. And if you recall, the first John Carter book is called A Princess of Mars, and it's a love story.
Yeah.
And that love story has to propel you for the first three novels. And I just didn't sense it. But in terms of, there were funny elements to it. I thought the Tharks and Tars Tarkas and that company were amazingly well done. The origin is straightforward from Burroughs.
It was a period piece. I couldn't believe that.
It's a period piece. And the biggest problem the film has, and it's not the fault of the film, it's the fault of nothing, is that almost every good element of John Carter has in the last 100 years been ripped off. John Carter was done 102 years ago. It was I think it was 1912. I could be off for a year, but you know, it's 100 years old. And almost everything great about it has been picked up by somebody else. I loved it when I read it because I had never read any of the other stuff that stole from it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly all the big stuff, like a lot of Star Wars or whatever else, that they didn't come until much later. So I liked it. I don't have the problem. And I told my wife about it, and I was invited to a preview of the film, and my wife watched it later on TV because she didn't want to come into LA for that. She watched it on her own and said she liked it too, and she was not even a fan of the original books. I don't think it's a bad film. I think Disney just didn't push it in the right way or care about it that much.
Yeah, there were definitely some marketing missteps happening there. And yeah. I'm so glad to hear you say that too, though, because one of my co-hosts, Daniel, and I, we both were standard bearers with that movie. We love that movie. We enjoyed it so much. We were so disappointed because, yeah, you know, the box office, definitely a sequel was not going to happen, you know. But we got that movie, though. That's the thing, is no yeah. sequel, but yeah, we still, on my shelf, I have that movie and I can watch it. And it thrilled me, it, just in that kind of, going back to that inner 15-year-old or inner 14-year-old yeah. who's just, you know, enjoying the adventure and the romance to it. But
now, I had read, when I worked at Disney back in the early 90s, I read a couple of drafts by different writers of what a John Carter film could be. And several of them got it, several of them didn't. The biggest problem was it's so expensive to make.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately Disney didn't have the belief that the film could make back money. And they're probably right, because, again, every element of it had been taken. So it would not feel fresh to a lot of people. It would, in fact, feel old. But on a basis of just seeing a film, I liked it.
So you mentioned you working at Disney. You've worked in comics. You've also worked in animation. What are some of the things in animation that you've done? Because I don't know much about your animation career, other than when I met you at Wizard World, I saw you had some scripts for the Godzilla cartoon series that came out after that 90s movie.
A lot of Transformers stuff. I developed Beast Machines for Transformers. I was one of the original story editors on the first run of Transformers, and I co-wrote the Optimus Prime two-parter that brings him back to life.
Oh, nice. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I was story editor for CBS Superman TV cartoon show. I was story editor for Monster Force from Universal. I did the Batman cartoon show. I've done a ton of stuff over the years.
So how does that compare to your work in comics? And I'm not going to ask you to choose between babies here. I'm not going to say, you know, which one's better, you know. But how does it compare?
It's different. When you're doing comics, you can say which one is more fun. When you're doing comics, it's mostly what you want to do. It's mostly your feelings, mostly your interests involved. When you're doing animation, unless you developed it, what you're trying to do is fit in with an entire group of writers who have to write fairly similarly for a project so that all the episodes of something or other feel the same to some degree. So for personal statements, comics are a lot better. For the fun of doing moving characters and the type of stories that it would be a little bit harder to do live action unless you're going to have a $200 million mm-hmm. Transformers movie, you know, animation is wonderful. I love writing animation, but comics are still the more personal thing that I write. I also write video games, and I've done other things as well. Yeah. Okay.
So what are you working on these days then?
Well, I'm finishing a number of issues of a special project for DC, which I can't talk about.
Okay.
I'm working on a novelization of something I'm also not allowed to talk about.
Okay.
And there's a couple of other things that are about to start.
That you can't talk about?
No.
Okay.
Everyone these days, like never before, has you sign non-disclosure agreements. I think all the companies want to be in charge of their own promotion and mm-hmm. own advertising, and they don't want the people who are doing the episodes or the comics or whatever else to get in the way of their program. And they're spending the money, so they have the right to call for that. But what it does mean is, unfortunately, I can't talk about what I'm doing most of the time until they announce it.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, back, you know, 1978, you didn't have the internet you weren't on the internet doing interviews with podcasters and, you know, Newsarama and Bleeding Cool or anything like that. I mean, It just didn't exist. So if you told someone about it at a convention, maybe 20 more people would find out. But
there were fanzines, and that would go out to a certain number of people. And so information got out there, but it was a little bit harder. Now, of course, you don't even have to leave your office.
Right. Yeah, it's true. Which we're both in our offices right now.
Yeah, I mean, we're anywhere a phone with internet connection is.
Okay, well, I have one last question that I have to ask you, because one of my other co-hosts, Matt, he's reading Crisis on Infinite Earths, and he said, "Hey, Ben, ask him about Crisis on Infinite Earths." I was like, what? Well, that's really broad and not really not really a question. So I tried to think of a question I could ask you that maybe hasn't been asked a million times. Maybe I succeeded, maybe not. But here's my question. What's a memory that you have about the either the creation or the reception of Crisis on Infinite Earths, as far as maybe readers or you working on it, or however you want to interpret the question, but a good memory about Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Well, the production of doing the book was the hardest thing I've ever done. I worked several years creating that plot and making it work. It's a very well-structured story, and I can say that because I did have to read it recently, and it's still held up, and it's very complex. And I know that the only way you could do something of that sort is to take your time with it. And I had a couple of years to actually work it out. But it was the hardest book in the world to have done. It was incredibly difficult, and it was a major problem because nobody had ever done a book like that before. Therefore, the other editors and the other writers at the company were not thrilled by it, or even the concept of it.
Oh, really?
They wanted everything to stay exactly the way it was when they got into comics, despite the fact that it was now a whole new generation of readers behind it. So it was a very, very difficult and argumentative time, and just hard to put it together. I love the writing of it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about the creative process. The creative process was wonderful, especially after George Perez decided he wanted to be on the book. I hoped he would, but we didn't think he would be. Because he was going to go off and do Wonder Woman, and I didn't think we'd be doing another book together so soon after Titans. And it wasn't written with him in mind, and he kept saying no to the very idea until he finally went, "I got to do this book." And I think he's happy now that he did. But so the creative was one thing. That was great. It was just George and me. The political situation of trying to produce it was very difficult. The fan reaction, even though people would come up and say they didn't like the fact that Supergirl died or Flash died, they all said they died in the best way they could possibly have gone. And people tell me constantly that it was the most important story of their childhood, which is amazing to me because I didn't think that the comic in itself would be remembered. I thought the new universe we were going to create was going to be the thing that people would remember. And the comic that led to it was just the highway that took you to the destination. But it turns out that it was the book itself that's held on all these years, and that's why it's constantly in reprint and constantly coming out there in beautiful editions. The DC Absolute version of it is just one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen. Done in comic book format. It's oversized, beautiful paper, great ink, great color. So the fan reaction has been astounding, even if they didn't want to see Supergirl or Flash or one of the others die. Today, it's incredibly gratifying because people come up and just say how much they love it.
That's got to feel, I mean, as a creator, you let your baby go, and then
yeah.
to see your baby actually grow up and make a better world, so to speak. You know?
Well, you have no idea. Also, because it had never been done before, and it was a really controversial concept, since characters were going to die, and worlds were going to stop, and the multiverse was going to come to an end, it could have been taken horribly. And yeah, there were people who didn't like it, but I'd say of the male reactions that I got then, 95% of the people loved it, and the reaction that I get today is almost universally 100%. I haven't gotten anyone who said how much they hated it or something. I have a hunch they just wouldn't come up to me after 30 years and say something like
They'd
that.
They'd have to really hate it to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And considering what's come out since, I think the book would still hold up.
Yeah, well, and I think it's the least of sins, I think, considering some of the things that have happened. So, well, I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me about old comics. I mean, that's what the Comic Book Time Machine is about, is going back in time. But do you have a I know you have a website, but would you like to let our listeners know what your website is? And
sure.
And if you have any work that you want to promote right now, you can go ahead and do that too. But,
well, as I say, I can't talk about most of the stuff I'm working on. Keep your eyes open to my Facebook page, which is the Marv Wolfman page or whatever it's called. My website is marvwolfman.com. And it has interesting back features about the Titans and writing and a whole bunch of other things. And lots of pictures of celebrities who have played my characters on TV and movies. Yes.
That's actually kind of cool when I was looking at that, though, because I was trying to imagine, what does it feel like to see, you know, to see them on the screen and just – and moving, you know?
Yeah. So it's a great feeling.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And
my pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Okay, you take care.
You too. Once more, I want to thank Mr. Wolfman for joining us to talk about John Carter and talking about him and his career. But now to examine one of Mr. Wolfman's John Carter stories. John Carter, Warlord of Mars, Annual Number 1, is loosely adapted from Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Ancient Dead. To read this, if you want to read this today, you'll need to get that Marvel Omnibus, which is only $25 in some places. In fact, the Wizard World convention, if I had forgotten to bring my Omnibus, I would have easily and happily plopped down $25 to have him sign it. I mentioned that I read the book first, and this is something that I like to do. I like to check out the source material, see what they did with the, or, you know, see the original and then see what they did with it later on. So, for example, I've already watched the movie The Deep for my next Marvel sci-fi licensed episode, and I'm going to be watching Star Trek The Motion Picture when that pops up, and I'm going to be watching the first few episodes of Battlestar Galactica when I get to them. So here's the setup, and like I said before, The Ancient Dead has an interesting setup and an interesting concept in the beginning, and it has actually a kind of visual and even emotional ending. Unfortunately, between point A and point B, well, Edgar Rice Burroughs kind of drops the ball for me twice. And one of them was so bad that it totally just turned me against the story. And I rolled my eyes. I crossed my arms. I almost spoke out loud. I didn't speak out loud and say, oh, come on, or anything like that. But I was thinking it. It was in my head. So when I got to the end, I was doing something that I rarely do. And that was I was rooting for Mr. Wolfman to fix the story. I wanted him to change this story. And this goes against almost, not quite, but almost every fiber in my being. I'm generally speaking an adapting purist, depending on the intent and the source. Now, if you're just taking characters and you're just taking inspiration, that's one thing. You know, Frankenstein and Dracula movies, they tend to do that. They're taking the inspiration, they're taking the mood, they're taking the character, they're taking the basic concept, and then they're casting it into a new story or a similar story, but they're not trying to say this is the same story. Then you have something like Bram Stoker's Dracula. Or even worse, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and it's not. They're saying it's the same, but they are not doing the same thing. And if you're going to say it belongs to someone else, then you need to own it and say it belongs to someone else. Like I say before, when I do my adaptations of George Martin's Hedge Knight books, it's George Martin's name above the title, not mine. And so I want to make sure that I'm as pure and as close to the original as can be, based on the fact that it is two different mediums. So here I am, and I'm going to read an adaptation by Mr. Wolfman of this story, and I'm wondering, okay, how is he going to honor the story, and is he going to say, no, I'm not going to honor it completely because there's some stupid, stupid stuff in here. But normally, you know, I just want to say be as pure as possible based on the time and space constraints. you know, if you're trying to take a novel and turn it into a six-page comic, well, obviously you're going to have to leave some stuff out, but not change everything completely. But here I'm actually rooting for him to do that. Now, I did, on the front page, the title page, it does say it is loosely adapted. That gives him more freedom. And it gives me more optimism. Now, looking at the cover page, When Walk the Ancient Dead is the title that Marv Wolfman gives to this story, loose basically on The Ancient Dead by Edgar Rice Burroughs. It's Marv Wolfman, writer-editor. Sal Buscema and Ernie Chan are the artists. Joe Rosen is the letterer, and Janice Cohen is the colorist. So we do have a new art team here working on things. And honestly, I'm just going to give a quick preview of the artwork. Again, I'm just kind of glancing through it. They really stick with the Gil Kane feel of things, and there is definitely still that energy and that swashbuckling feel. And part of it has to do with those pirate boots with the fold over top, and part of it has to do with I think that they are trying to ape the Gil Kane feel of the monthly book. But at the same time, it's not Gil Kane. I'll just put it that way. I've grown used to Gil Kane on the book, and honestly, I know he doesn't stay on the title for the entire run. He will be missed, even if the art is as good as this. I think I'm going to miss him. So here's a brief synopsis of Edgar Rice Burroughs' original story. It's a fairly simple story. John Carter is going out for a fly. He's flying in his flying ship over the Barsoonium landscape to get some fresh air and to just, you know, clear his head and think about things. Think about life. Philosophize a little bit. And in the original novel, this is actually happening toward the end of the novels. And John Carter, he's long living. In fact, he's actually, he's had life before the first book, apparently. And I don't know all the details about how that works with him being that kind of like that immortal warrior. But he's been around for a long time. He's got he's got children, grandchildren, and all that kind of thing. He looks and he sees a white Martian, and those white Martians are actually from the early days of Mars. You have red Martians, you have green Martians, and then you have this white Martian who has a skin tone similar to John Carter's, and he's being attacked by green Martians. And of course, John Carter intervenes, saves the man, whose name is Pandan Chi. But Pandan Chi tells John Carter to leave, to go away. John stays instead and finds himself surrounded by people, and they take him into their ancient city. And he finds himself in a setup for, honestly, this could be any number of different things where it's that insular town. It could be a Twilight Zone where there's just a group of people who live in this town that hasn't been touched by time for ages. Or it could be a 70s horror movie kind of setup. Or it could be, honestly, a 70s or 80s, you know, traveling do-gooder. The Incredible Hulk, he comes into a small village that no one has left the village for a long time. And then, of course, he turns into the Hulk and helps somebody out. But it's just that setup. There's this nice setup here because the city that Pandan Chi comes from has been undiscovered by the outside. And I shouldn't say undiscovered because any outsiders who do come to the city, they're killed. And so if the city gets discovered, they are going to stay a secret. And the secret will never be taken to the outside world because the outsiders are killed. But Pandan Chi stands for John Carter, and he asks for some grace. They don't give grace. He says, but he saved my life. They don't care. And John Carter tries to bargain a deal with them. You know, he's obviously got some influence and they could be allies, but they're not having any of that. They want to have their insular closed town or city. They don't want anyone to come inside. But Pandan Chi is able to get a stay of execution for John and asks for them to deliberate overnight. And so John Carter and Pandan are put in these ancient pits where no one who has gone in has ever come out. They're just going to stay in the entrance, though. And John Carter then moves from a 70s horror movie setup or a Twilight Zone setup and instantly walks into basically a Dungeons and Dragons scenario. They wander the ancient catacombs. They fight and have random encounters with giant Usios, which are basically rat creatures from Barsoom, which means that they have, you know, 8 legs. And these ones are supposed to, they're generally smaller, but these are the size of panthers. And as they're traveling and fighting and everything, they're getting to know each other. And they happen to have some torches, with these everlasting torches that the people of the city have. And they're getting ready to play a game like chess. And John Carter just happens to have his set with him. They took his swords, but not his chess set. And the pieces are hand-carved, and they're hand-carved likenesses of real people, including Lilana, or Lana, however, I'm going to say Lana. It's two L's, but I'm going to pronounce it with one. John Carter's granddaughter. And Pandan sees this piece, this chess piece, and falls in love with the most beautiful woman he has ever seen. Let me say that again. He picks up a chess piece that is a carved likeness of John Carter's granddaughter, and he falls in love with a carved chess piece. It's love at first sight, and he would do anything for this woman. So now we get into some of the plot that I really found very interesting. This chess piece thing, I did not like it. But you know what? At this point, I can live with it. I just think the guy's a little weird. I'm not realizing that I'm being set up. Edgar Rice Burroughs is setting me up for one of my huge pet peeves in storytelling. But we'll get to it. In the pits, these pits are millions of years old, and they're actually kind of a catacombs kind of thing. And they're from a time when Barsoom had rich blue oceans. And in times past, people would end up in the pits, and they would never come out. Now, John Carter doesn't care about that because he believes that they came in that entrance, and they're supposed to go back out the next day to find out what their sentence is going to be, if it's going to be a death sentence or not. John Carter, he is going to find the other end. He is going to find the other way out. Now, Pandan does care. He is going back, even if that means he has to drag John Carter with him. And so they end up facing off. They're going to fight. They are using weapons from a sarcophagus that, you know, where a dead body was. And Pandan just can't put any effort into it, though. He couldn't kill John Carter. John Carter's too honorable. He's an honorable man. And besides, he's the grandfather of the woman that Pandan loves. He hasn't met him. He's only seen the chess piece likeness of her. But he's the grandfather of that woman. So they continue together. And these dead bodies in these sarcophaguses, they should be dust because they are from millions of years ago. But they are perfectly preserved. And Pandan tells the story about this rumor that back in the day, millions of years ago, there was a master embalmer who was able to... And I love this. This is kind of fun. This is kind of that fun, funny legend kind of thing that, you know, just lasts throughout time. And I like the way this goes, but he says that this man was able to embalm bodies so well that the dead person themselves didn't realize they were dead, and they would get up and walk around. So there's also this kind of crazy evil laugh that they hear every once in a while, and they see light at the ends of some tunnels every once in a while, and they finally find the source of the laugh and the light, and that's an ancient madman who embalms people who get lost down there. And I get the impression, although I don't think it was actually said outright, but I get the impression that when he embalms people, it allows him to live longer. And there's a magical connection between the embalmed people and him. And we'll get to that in a moment here. But he obviously is going to try and embalm John Carter and Pandan. And they're his next victims. But, of course, they kill him. Now, after they kill him, the other victims wake up, and this is kind of creepy, and I'm not sure what's going to happen next here, because these are corpses coming back to life, but corpses from millions of years ago, or a million a year ago. The timeline doesn't matter. These are people who are supposed to have been dead for millennia. And I shouldn't say that, because there is one of them who was only there for a very short time. You see, she came in that other end that John Carter was convinced exists because she was on the run from a warlord who had kidnapped her. And when she escaped by causing their ship to crash, she just happened to find that opposite entrance to the pits. And she was captured and she was embalmed. And so when she comes out of the sarcophagus coffin thingy that he had them put in, John Carter recognizes her. It's Lana. Yes, his granddaughter. So John Carter, Pandan, and Lana who now Pandan has seen her face to face and has dedicated his life to her with an oath. They join the ancient dead by walking to the exit of the pits. John Carter, now they get to the end. John Carter has escaped his death sentence. Pandan, he has found the living embodiment of the chess piece he fell in love with. Lana is annoyed with this common man who is interested in her. And the ancient ones are shocked that the world they knew just minutes ago for them, because as far as they were concerned, they were embalmed just minutes ago. None of that time, they were not even aware of that time that had passed. And they are shocked to the point where some start weeping. Some even start committing suicide, stabbing themselves through with their knives as soon as they go out and see the dead seas, the sandy landscape. There is no life. There are, you know, just a few plants. There is no water. And then, and I'm spoiling the whole thing here, I guess. I'm just going to do it. They crumble to dust and they blow away in the wind. And it's a very poignant scene. And it kind of redeems things a little bit for me, but only a little bit. And so then John Carter's flyer is gone because somebody, probably the warlord or his men, have taken it. So the trio have to make their way across the desert over 1,000 miles. Mr. Chi is determined to woo Lana while they travel together. And even when he kills a banth, it doesn't help. She is not impressed. Not one bit. Now, maybe by the end of the fourth novella that makes up this book, they'll be together. Maybe as they travel this long journey, this long and difficult journey, it'll be like the Barsoomian version of moonlighting. I don't know. And I don't care. Because I have two problems with this story. Two problems, one word, Lana. Now, perhaps this is meant to be parody. I did read something online that said that maybe Edgar Rice Burroughs was doing some self-parody, because this is coming toward the end of his career. It doesn't read that way, though. The lost, isolated civilization, this is world-building, and it's good world-building. It's interesting. You're getting this view and this glimpse into the past of Barsoom. You're seeing these people who have isolated themselves and tried to keep their society the same as it was way back when. And then you get a second layer of that, where you have people who actually are from that society that they have been trying to preserve. These people have been literally preserved, and they come out of their preserve, and you get a glimpse into actually their own perspective of things. And it's very interesting. You have these parallel preservations of the past. And I love this. I love these parallel preserved societies. And yes, only one of them gets an interesting resolution. Maybe in one of the other novellas, the people of the city actually chase them down. But as far as I know, the novella only gives us one resolution, where the people who have been preserved come out into the fresh air, basically, and they fade away, they fall away. But Pandan falls in love with a chess piece, and the subject of the chess piece just happens to have been captured and embalmed in a place that just happens to be where John Carter's next adventure is taking place. And that is a place that is completely unknown to the outside world. So John Carter and Lana both accidentally find this place that has been lost for generations in the middle of nowhere. And just before they cross paths, John Carter just happens to show a chess piece carved like his granddaughter to someone who is inclined to fall in love with her on the spot. This better be parody. Okay, it doesn't feel like parody. It doesn't feel like it to me. It feels straight. It feels legit. But these coincidences are of Thor the Dark World proportions. They're coincidences meant for one reason and one reason only: to get this character to fall in love with that character so that they can have wacky adventures afterward, I guess. This bothered me. So I read the novella, and I enjoyed parts, and I hated parts. And all I could think was, I hope he fixes this. I hope he fixes this. And I'm so happy to say he did. Going into the comic now, the same basic plot is there, but I'm going to tell you what the changes were. Here's what Mr. Wolfman did. Instead of a chess piece that John Carter just happens to carry around, he carries around a chess set. It's not chess. It's a game like chess. I'm just calling it a chess piece for the ease of things, but he's carrying it around. They take away his sword, but they don't take away his pouch with his chess set. And anyway, instead of a chess set, John Carter and Pandan are walking to their trial. And Pandan points out an ancient statue of a woman that he finds to be gorgeous. He finds this image, this graven image, this statue of someone from their ancient past to be gorgeous, to be beautiful, to be regal, to be royal. And he has grown to love her over time. This makes sense to me. Now, is it still a little weird? Yes, it is still a little weird. But it is a lot more realistic and a lot more natural than to just fall in love on the spot with a chess piece. This is a statue that was carved at the time of the people who were disappearing into the catacombs. Now, this makes sense then when this woman climbs out of a tomb when John Carter and Pandan are down there. Now, unfortunately, the one thing is, I got the impression from the story that when the embalmer was killed, there was this connection between him and his victims. I don't get that from the story here. When the embalmer is thrown against a pillar, he doesn't die. He stays alive, and he actually interacts with the victims, and they're not happy with what he's done with them. So I'm not sure exactly why they start to wake up, but I don't even think I would be asking the question as much if I hadn't read the story, the original story. They do just happen to wake up at just the right time, and he interacts with them. But like I said, she is one of them who comes out, and this makes sense. Now, Lana, John Carter's granddaughter, is gone from the story. And maybe Mr. Wolfman did this because he wanted to shift things to take place closer to the time period where the main monthly series was taking place. Or maybe Mr. Wolfman did this because this is clown shoes, this whole chess piece thing. And he realized this, maybe. I don't know. But the story flows logically now. And the love story actually has some resonance. It's still quick. Now it's on her part that it's quick. And, you know, he talks strange because, you know, they're millions of years separated. She's royalty. But as they're talking, she invites him to her chambers to entertain her, quote unquote. And later in her chambers, they do some talking and they do some not talking, as my old high school chum used to say, the same high school chum, I might add, who borrowed and never returned my copies of Battlestar Galactica issues 1-3. But that's not important. We have some time before we get to that. So now, without the Pandan Lana relationship and Banth battle at the end to end on, Mr. Wolfman has to make, you know, another change. He has to change the ending here. It's a different relationship between the two of them. So he makes one more significant change, and that's this big battle between John Carter and some of the warriors who came back to life. They chase each other around the ruins, and it gets a little surreal. And at the end, Mr. Wolfman even goes for kind of an emotional kick. Whether or not it works, well, I'm not going to say too much. I don't want to spoil everything, although I pretty much have spoiled almost everything. He fixed the big problem, though. He fixed my big problem, and I'll just leave it at that. I'll just say that there is some of the same tragedy that was in the original with those people who came out of their time into this new time, this new world. There's some of that tragedy there. And even with that, though, it's a happy ending for me. Now, I'm not as engaged as I am with the Air Pirates storyline. But as a one-off, it's good. It's good. And the goodwill of the Air Pirates story is there for me with this story. And so even though this story doesn't capture me as much as the other ones do, because of the Air Pirates stories, I read this and I think to myself, I'm enjoying myself because I'm in a familiar place. Even though the artwork is slightly different, it's just a little bit. It's just left of center, let's say. So that, I guess, that kind of concludes things here. I don't want to go on much more. I do say, still, buy that omnibus. This is a book that I cannot recommend strongly enough, even though I said I was going to wait until the end of the story arc to say whether or not it's worth it. What I've read, 5 issues and an annual, has been well worth the $25 that I spent on this. Now, at $100, I think there I need to continue reading to see if it's worth it at that price. But I have a feeling, if this is any indication, that it will be. And once I get, you know, through the 12 issues of the Air Pirates of Mars, I'll be able to, you know, recommend the book at full price, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. But as it stands right now, I cannot say enough how pleasantly surprised I've been by John Carter, Warlord of Mars. It's just been exciting and interesting, and it's that pulpy, exciting sci-fi that it just, there's a satisfaction to that kind of storytelling. There's a satisfaction to, you know, 2001 as well. And you can't get much further away from 2001 than John Carter, unless you're going to go in a completely different direction where you're going toward, you know, Plan 9 from Outer Space kind of stuff. Just, again, you're kind of going to clown shoes to get to that other side away from 2001. But I really am enjoying this book, and a great surprise, and just an exciting, exciting read. So I want to thank you again for listening. Again, I want to thank Mr. Wolfman for taking the time to sit down and talk. And if you want to add your own 2 cents, if you have anything you want to add or have any thoughts about what Mr. Wolfman said, please contact us at feedback@comicbooktimemachine.com. That's our email address. If you go to comicbooktimemachine.com, you can also leave comments on the episode blog posts. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbooktimemachine. And all of these places, we would love to hear from you. We do this because we enjoy comics, and we hope that you enjoy listening to us talk about comics we enjoy, but we also want to hear from you about the comics that you enjoy. So once again, that email address is feedback@comicbooktimemachine.com. Now, you can also hear me talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at welcometolevel7.com. That's a podcast about Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Welcome to Level 7, that I co-host with Daniel Butcher. You can also find me talking about sci-fi and fantasy and faith and Christianity at strangersandaliens.com. And my personal website is benavery.com. And we have Facebook sites for all those things, but those are just different places you can find me. So again, I thank you for listening, and until next time, I'm just going to leave you with some advice that I picked up just by reading this story, and that is to say, if your friend has a chess set that they always carry around with them, that the pieces are carved from people from his life and family, and one of those chess pieces happens to be a very, very beautiful woman or handsome man or whatever, I would suggest maybe waiting until you meet the person to fall in love with them. I'm just saying. I could be wrong. But I'm probably not.